You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to what I think is a quite special edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This, of course, is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today's date is the 4th of May, 2026, the early morning hours. Many of you are aware that Pete Quijones and myself have been going through Alexander Solzhenitsyn's 200 Years Together, line by line, page by page, for the last year and a half. And we have finally completed it. If you haven't, I can't imagine you haven't heard about it. It's actually quite, become quite popular. The family's all upset with us. That is to say, the Solzhenitsyn family, you know, they're very interested in other things other than the truth of the matter. But, and we just, well, 2 days ago, did our, the two of us did a summary of what we came out with. What are the basic themes, concepts? What did we, you know, what are the main issues that came out of that book? What can we do about it? And I can't help but I have to do my own version of that today. It's hard to consider a more important book, not only for recent Russian history, but even American history. The Solzhenitsyn family keeps saying they're going to have an English translation. They keep pushing it back. Now it's late 2026. I'm not sure I believe them. But, you know, after going through that book word by word, it trying to find those specific things that really stuck out can be difficult. Now, for those who don't know, I know there's some young people who listen to this show. Alexander Solzhenitsyn was a Russian dissident, awarded the 1970 Nobel Prize in Literature for his book, The Gulag Archipelago, and he was a prisoner there. It was a challenge to the Soviet state, and God knows how many copies it sold. He was sentenced initially to 8 years by Smersh, or, you know, Soviet counterintelligence. After World War II, he was a artillery officer for the Soviets. Sentenced to 8 years, and then internal exile. And it's his return to, because of his experience in these camps, which were inhuman by any measure, he returned to his roots in the Orthodox Church. In fact, he was, for the most part, an old believer. Now, during the so-called thaw, which I think is something that is wildly exaggerated under Khrushchev, I think that was mostly a press release more than anything else, that was the only reason he was released from the camps. He wasn't exonerated. But it, you know, they weren't quite sure what to do with him. His first novel didn't really come out until 1962. One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. But once Khrushchev was overthrown in 1964, Soviet authorities were really now at odds with him. Abroad, he wrote The Cancer Ward in 1966, The First Circle, 1968, August 1914, 1971, and of course, his The Archipelago in 1973, or at least with an English translation there. He won the 1970 Nobel Prize for that book in Russian. But when Brezhnev took over, he was outraged at this. He was stripped of his Soviet citizenship. He was not, you know, not like the old days. He wasn't murdered. He was flown to West Germany, then Switzerland, and then Vermont. For whatever reason, that's where his family had settled, and he was an old believer there. There apparently was some sort of an old believer community there, St. Nicholas, I'm not sure. And he continued to write. But when the party monopoly was eliminated, roughly in 1990, his citizenship was restored. He returned to Russia 4 years later, and he remained in Russia until his death in 2008. It's hard to murder someone who's won the Nobel Prize. Not when it comes to 200 Years Together, which is, you know, one of his last books. It's very difficult when a Nobel Prize winner, a brilliant writer, a man who knows what the camps are like, comes out and tells the truth about the Jews. He doesn't say it in a harsh manner. He doesn't say it in the protocols nonsense. Not like that. But it was written very intelligently and with a great eye to historical accuracy. And that's what flipped out the Western European historical establishment. It's a miracle that they've maintained his... I guess there's really no way to strip a Nobel Prize from somebody. Over the years, I've written substantially on Solzhenitsyn. And I'm not really sure if I could summarize him in any way. In my book on Russian literature, I do have a list of what I call essential ideas. What I wrote is essential ideas pregnant with the others. Never to be completely exhausted, but continually evocative of further critique. Now, nothing in Solzhenitsyn's work ever constituted a system, but a few axioms of thinking, which would be mentioned, that if understood in context, can lead to a rational life, an understanding of politics, whether Russian or anywhere else. Happiness, as a concept, was one of the chief interests of this man. I guess it's really a concern for everyone. I like to use the word contentment instead, or satisfaction. And after writing on him for so many years, I came up with a list of concepts that might... It won't summarize Solzhenitsyn. We'll give you a background into understanding what sort of a man he was, intellectually speaking. The first is that the existence of any elite, whether, you know, an elite is by definition, you know, oligarchic, it's correlated with an ideology. They are the master institution. Institutions, elites, ideologies, they're one and the same thing, seen from different points of view. Russia had gone through a trauma that very few societies. There was certainly nothing in history. No society in history had gone through before that point. Later, it occurred in China, in Cambodia, and in Vietnam. But how do you come out of that? And that's been Putin's big mission. When a society is revolutionized, so to speak, it's brought under the heading of ideology. Elites become more and more powerful and less responsible. All crimes could be placed under the heading of building socialism or creating diversity or whatever the slogan is at the moment. Modern politics, campaigns, elections, voting, that kind of thing, that's just a matrix for power. As I wrote many years ago, it's a mystification for power. The great empires of the past, power has not become more diffuse. It's just simply gone under different names. Various disguises, mystifications. An oligarchy rules in the NATO states just as powerfully as they did in Babylon. Although I suppose under Babylon they weren't calling themselves the manifestation of liberty and progress. There's no question that Solzhenitsyn was anti-modernist, again, in a very broad sense. Machiavelli and Hobbes, I think Hobbes far more so, leading to positivism and empiricism, created the concept that matter is dead and is formless and has no, it simply exists. Without value, until the elite recreate it or perfect it according to a certain plan or ideology. This specific elite, in the revolutionary elite in Russia, started with Peter the Great. My book I'm working on is called The Demiurge. It's very Gnostic in his case. The higher the arrogance quotient of the elites, the more rarefied the ideology, and vice versa. Number two, and this is a more personal issue, this really isn't. No one is justified in criticizing others, whether they have power or not, without first being very harsh on themselves. I'm way ahead of you, thank God, on that. Modern politics, no matter what the type, seems to be reducible to a gradual displacement of responsibility, something monarchs never had the luxury of doing. Everything was on them. Everything was their fault, whether it was true or not. Power today is protected when its vices are projected onto others. And you've heard me say this many, 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 many times. The vices of Soviet life, for example, were displaced into American racism or reactionaries abroad or internal Hitlerites or whatever the slogan might be. American purposelessness is projected onto something like religious fanaticism, wicked nationalism, and sometimes even criticism itself. Criticism is justified only if one has torn themselves apart internally. And that includes as a party, as an individual, as a religion, as an ethnic group, or a nation. And it's possible in all of these areas. And once that's done, external criticism loses its displacing and projecting character. So if there's going to be any social reform, and of course, Solzhenitsyn didn't really believe in political reform, certainly believed in social reform. That's where it was going to start, repentance and humility. Number three, concerning the Soviet Union, Solzhenitsyn made a big deal of the difference between accepted criticism of the regime and unreasonable criticism of it, which is identical to what we have in the West. Although the punishments certainly differ. Regardless of where we live, we suffer under a regime where major media dictate the parameters of debate. They dictate the nature of the evidence that we're allowed to use. And even more importantly, what's considered reasonable. Worthwhile. Now, in the post-Stalin Soviet Union, criticizing him was sort of a substitute for criticizing Marxism. The point of de-Stalinization under Khrushchev was a method for deflecting criticism of the Soviet Union as a whole. As I've said before, Stalin did not develop any new doctrine. He did not create the camp system or the mass executions. That goes way back. He did not create any, and certainly Lenin was, and Trotsky were identical to Stalin in this regard. Lenin in the Soviet era was considered almost a god of sorts. As time went on, Stalin was seen to be almost a demon. It was a form of damage control, and you've heard me talk about this many times before. In the West, slogans of McCarthyism were used to deflect any criticism of the extreme leftward turn in American social life after the 1960s. What was considered Marxist propaganda in the 1930s was considered legitimate conservatism in the 1970s. This is what I mean, dictating what is policing a movement. The Soviet Union, de-Stalinization had the same effect, serving nothing but the very state that created Stalin in the first place. In the West, while the official stance of the U.S. government was anti-communist, year after year, the Reds received millions in American food aid and technical support, and trade was, there were no sanctions on the Soviet Union. So they may condemn, the government may condemn Marxism, the regime did not. State-financed universities all over the Western world gave huge salaries to openly Marxist and Leninist professors, while allegedly spending money to defeat Marxism abroad. My book on the military dictators of Latin America, so-called, the U.S. did not support them. The U.S. was very distrustful of them, and they had good reason for it. Politics, in other words, in the manipulation of language, is a theater of deceit. Words in postmodernity are used to mask reality, not describe it. Ideologies deliberately simplify reality so that elite can take power with some popular support, then legitimize their power later. Power manipulation are radically sublimated through public relations, PR, TV soundbite in the name of freedom. Words are emptied of meaning solely to defend an oligarchy, whether socialist, liberal, or religious, of one type or another. Number four, priorities, moral and political priorities, issues. They don't exist in a vacuum. They are decided upon by this same group of people with power. When any scientist or historian begins writing, performing research, the topics that he decides upon are decided by the system of power, the nature of the discipline. You've heard me say a few times, you know, I'm not going to, the Daily Nationalist, for example, I'm not going to let the system tell me what's important and what isn't. And there's some truth to that. There's a lot of truth to that. The world doesn't go away just because Israel's in serious trouble. In America, major media is owned by a handful of Jewish families. They decide on everything. Issues, debates, all of which is dictated by the executives, board members, investors in this conglomerate. Can priorities exist outside of those? In an institution that has power. Well, sure. But so only so long as the natural needs of the nation, you know, basic economics, preservation, tradition, and family, love of God, etc., are maintained. But after World War II, you had two revolutionary developments. You had liberal capitalism in the West, liberal democracy in the West, and Marxism in the East. Never let anyone tell you that what they did in the Soviet Union wasn't real Marxism. It most certainly was. Number four, there is no such thing as political reform as such. Normally considered, any reform is the exchange of one set of bosses for another. Remember, they're talking, you know, this is in the era of the America's lost war against Iran, which I predicted very easily predictable. You know, there was a time where dissidents in the U.S. held up in the USSR, I'm sorry, held the U.S. as a model of freedom and progress. And of course, Solzhenitsyn, as you all know, takes issue with that and took issue with that quite a bit. Solzhenitsyn was one of the first ones to teach me personally and so many others that socialism and liberal democracy are both revolutionary. They're very similar. At the fundamentals, they are the same, ideologically speaking. And I've been through this in some detail, but the Soviets and the USA hold material production to be the highest good. The economy, technological growth, That was considered the sine qua non of happiness. They both held that material reality underlies everything. And that there's nothing, by the way, that cannot be quantified. They take positivist science as the ultimate arbiter of truth. Both are utopian in the sense that they claim that technology and science will eventually solve all the problems of want, immorality, and emotional distress. They see themselves as the ending of a philosophy of history. They both believe in the progressive nature of urbanization and both claim to support feminism. They think legal abortion is wonderful and easy divorce. They've institutionalized the sexual revolution. Of course, in the USSR, that was eliminated pretty quickly. We should have given some pause in the U.S. is because everything began to collapse. Divorce, absurdly easy to acquire. Both are based on centralized forms of capital and technology. They both glorify warfare. Both believe, finally, and even more importantly, their respective forms of production are historically mandated. They will solve global problems like hunger and disease. Now, I know I've talked about this in more detail elsewhere, but it's very important to note that postmodern capitalism or advanced capitalism and advanced socialism are very, very, very similar at their foundations. And freedom was the end. Freedom was what everyone wanted and would be achieved. Both Western and Soviet concepts of freedom depended on a series of ideological presuppositions that were only really rarely made public. But it was to be achieved by technological innovation and science, guided, guarded, and interpreted by an elite. Number 7, we could say the same for multi-party democracy. The issue here is that a conditional good has been raised to the level of an intrinsic good. Parties are factions of elites who do whatever is necessary to maintain power, and they'll use the state against their opponents. A party is a faction. This faction is dedicated to gaining power and using that power at the expense of their opponents. Party politics centers around, once power is achieved, the avoidance of responsibility. Doesn't matter what system you're in or what the underlying agenda is, party leaders seek scapegoats to cover over the ruling clique's mistakes. And that creates the mentality of the herd. And that herd exists only to support and provide financial support for the elite factions or faction that runs the society. Number 8, we talked about happiness. This was a big deal to Solzhenitsyn. We live in an era where happiness is defined as something like material plenty. More than any other, I think, this issue arose over and over and over again in Solzhenitsyn's fiction. Moderns see happiness as the absence of poverty and material well-being. And both Marxists and capitalists agree with that. So by that argument, the American founding fathers, for example, would be less happy than the modern American. And if you read, as I have, Solzhenitsyn's fiction, happiness is juxtaposed to the most extreme conditions of degradation: hospital, camp, or laboratory, or any combination of those things. Clearly, he rejects this concept. The party that provides identity without substance is juxtaposed to the prison, where there's substance without freedom. the party provided perfunctory answers and these hackneyed speeches. They were regularly parodied in Solzhenitsyn's early work anyway. But what does real satisfaction come from? They come from struggle, through lived suffering. Nothing is worth having if you don't have to suffer to get it. Even something like the Gulag. Some of his characters, we can't get into that here, of course. Some of Solzhenitsyn's characters were happy for the first time in prison because they didn't have to be, they didn't have to have, they could be dissidents. They didn't have to kiss up to anybody. It's in the prison that happiness can be found, in prison because it is there, there alone, that one can truly become wise, live a life, while uncomfortable, is morally soothing. You're not working the system in that case. Happiness, in fact, is based on wisdom, and wisdom derives from suffering. So, those were, and I wrote that in my book on those 8 points. In my book on Russian literature, the ancient idea, or ancient Orthodox idea in Russian literature, many years ago. Now, with that background, where does Solzhenitsyn start his 200 years together? The master key. And I think this is the dominant element. Khazaria. The Khazar Empire, 8th, 9th century AD. It was one of the most violent, unpredictable, but still wealthy of the early medieval empires after the death of Attila the Hun. For those times, it occupied a pretty substantial territory. From Astrakhan to the Caspian Sea to the Dnieper, including Crimea. And the empire was situated mostly on the Volga side of the Black Sea, which offered tremendous financial benefits. And of course, it converted to Judaism. That is the teaching of the Talmud, roughly in the 9th century. J.B. Bury writes in 1912 in a book called The Empire of the Khazars and the Peoples of the North, there could be no question that the ruler, or Bulan at the time, was actuated by political motives in adopting Judaism to embrace Islam, Mohammedanism, would have made him a spiritual dependent of the caliphs. We can't have that. They certainly did attempt to press their faith on the Khazars. And in Christianity, the danger of his becoming an ecclesiastical vassal of the Roman Empire. Judaism, quote-unquote, was seen as a reputable religion with sacred books, with both Christian and Islamic, and Muslims respected. At least it elevated Khazaria above the heathen barbarians. But also secured people like Bulan, son Obadiah, secured them from interference from the caliph or the emperor. Now, of course, people were forced to convert, but that's an anachronism. You talk about a forcible conversion. Well, a population instinctively followed the religion of their rulers. Religion is not a private affair in the 8th and 9th century. But over time, even with that, the Talmudic idea grew in power and penetrated right up to there, even in the lower classes. Hebrew became the official script of the empire. A strong shift in burial patterns, for example, was discovered in recent archaeological digs. Actually, that was shortly after the initial elite conversion. Ahmad Ibn Fadlan, who was a Islamic merchant and traveler, he wrote roughly I think it's 922, said, "The Khazars and their kings are all Jews." Additionally, Ibn al-Faqih, around the same time, around 930, wrote, "All the Khazars are Jews, but they have been Judaized only recently." Keep in mind that when we talk about Judaism, we're referring only to the Talmud, the rabbinate. Their economy was somewhat of a mix of nomadic and pastoral life, but their big staple was taxing trade in the lower Volga and Dnieper on the Black Sea. I mean, don't underestimate fishing and agriculture, stuff like that, as economic variables, but mercantile trade and its taxation was the mainstay of the economy. The Khazars were the main slave dealers to the Islamic market. Raids into Slavic territories were to capture slaves, using the island of Kaffa as their headquarters. But even after the destruction of the Khazar Empire, their system lived on among the Volga Bulgars and some Turkic tribes, used by Jews to continually raid Russia. Going back a little bit, say by the 880s, Khazar control over the Dnieper from Kiev, where they collected tribute, began to weaken. The Kievan system, Kievan Rus as we know it, established itself. Oleg of Novgorod took control from Ashkold and Dir and laid the foundation for the rise of what we know as Kievan Rus. When other groups raided into Russia, it was usually at the behest of what was left of or that empire. That's how they functioned. And they needed to turn 50% of their take over to the empire. It served both their interests because it permitted the Muslim Arabs and the Rus to fight each other, leaving the Khazars as well-off middlemen. As Kiev grew in strength, its leadership attacked the Khanate more than once. In fact, it's not an exaggeration to say that much of the Russian identity came from its warfare with the Khanate. But certainly, the Cossack identity came directly from it. Now, the Khazars defeated Oleg in 941, and as a punishment, the Khazar shut down passage through the Volga. Byzantium and Russia were finding common ground against the Khazars. War was definitely coming. Even local tribes like the Pechenegs, the Turkic group, were slowly becoming a part of the Byzantine orbit. Oleg's successor, Svyatoslav I, who died in 972, stormed the Khazar capital of Itil in 968, and the city was razed to the ground. The bulk of Eastern European Jews come from the ruins of Khazaria, spreading throughout Europe after its demise. This is why 80% of the world's Jews were found in the Polish Empire. This also means that Gazadia could be considered a homeland for these Jews. If today's Israel continues to hemorrhage men and money in the constant wars, many Jews might come to see an alternative to the territory of the old Khazar Empire. Although much of that may be impossible right now. Then he moves on to Poland. Their power in Poland was almost absolute. It was their paradise. It was their paradise to the extent that they believed that the Messiah was coming. Starting in 1264, King Boleslav of Poland granted a charter inviting Jews to his empire. They were given unprecedented rights and privileges. Even to the point where the parliament in 1633 forbade Poland's nobility from selling liquor or engaging in commerce at all. These were warriors. Remember what Poland was. It was an oligarchy. It was no real monarchy. The oligarchs maintained control of Poland, and it, of course, was its undoing. Gliński, Krasiński, Kunikpolski, Leski, Majewski, Rasiński, Radziwill, Raków, Romer, so many others. And when you have these powerful oligarchic families running the country at the expense of the monarchy, the Jews were doing their accounting. The Council of the Four Lands was a central body of Jewish autonomy for almost two centuries, 16th to the 18th century. Jews at that time lived in the Kahal system. The latter part of the 16th century, the various Kahals met in Lithuania to create a supreme Jewish council to oversee the Jewish affairs in Poland, as well as Lithuania. And of course, it grew in tremendous power and was able to plug in to the commerce that the Jews dominated in places like Italy and Constantinople. I mean, don't think that it was always a network. Because this Polish elite owned the land, but really were unable, really incapable of engaging in commerce, they were forced to hand over the job of income extraction to the nation's Jews, who'd pay a set fee for a lease to raise the cash the nobility required. That short-term lease system was called the arrenda system. It was within the tax farming idea. The connection between those two, between the arrenda and tax farming, was so intimate that eventually, within the Polish language itself, it was one and the same thing. Arendarz, which tax farmer in Polish, was the same word used for Jew. Around 15% of urban and 80% of rural trade. And 80% of rural Jewish heads of households were occupied within this system. These can be taverns, these can be mills, the right to collect various payments, bridge tolls within a specific place. A Jew might take out a short-term lease on a church in defiance of canon law, for example. That means he was in sole possession of the church door. It can only be open for a fee. This is one of the things that led to rebellion and revolt amongst the Ukrainians. Another very important concept. And we used to laugh about it all the time over the last year and a half. Were these elite commissions that the Russians would create? One after another, after another, after another, on the foundation that Jews can become ordinary people. They were not. But it started with the famous Derzhavin Commission. That was the very first one. When Poland was finally collapsed, and what was left of it was divided among Prussia, Austria, and Russia. Unfortunately, Russia ended up with a huge number of Jews. And they were not aware of what this would mean. There was a lot of fighting, a lot of distrust between peasants and Jews. And both Emperors Paul and Alexander I had sent Derzhavin, who was the Philo-Semite for the most part, at least in the beginning, to go and see what the problem was, because they simply didn't know. And Derzhavin says, landlords, having granted Jews a monopoly over alcohol sales, worked together for the to the point where peasants had nothing. Well, this... And Jews, as powerful tax farmers, brought peasants to poverty, forcing peasants to take one loan to pay another one. Half a peasant income is easily taken this way, while peasant incomes would otherwise have been given a prosperous livelihood. There's quite a bit of naivete here. They really didn't know what the problem was. Derzhavin initially was a Philo-Semite. He did not leave there a Philo-Semite. The Jewish ownership of Orthodox parishes was a huge crime. I mean, the Polish nobility, though they were, you know, theologically, you know, semi-illiterate, were very Catholic. That made exploiting peasants much easier, since the farmer was religiously, ethnically, and culturally alien. The few Orthodox parishes remaining in eastern and southern Poland were padlocked for services until a substantial fee was paid to the Jewish leaseholder. And as might be imagined, this was the cause of endless revolts. And in fact, the entire Ukrainian Orthodox idea, the Ukrainian national idea, came from rebellions against this. Worst of all, the Slavic peasant had proven himself to be an excellent cultivator of large amounts of grain. But the more they cultivated, the less money they got. This was during the, you know, slightly post-Renaissance spike in Western populations. So Eastern grain was at a premium. Well, it didn't benefit them. That also forced the money economy to grow. It brought grain demand to a very high pitch, increasing the price and actually using currency rather than paying in kind. And when you start using currency, this is when you started having utter dependency. You know, as the way we did the book, Pete would read usually two or three paragraphs, and I would comment on it. And I have some interest in organized crime in the U.S., and the Jews behave precisely the same way. They function in the same way. Once they became part of the Russian Empire, they were heavily involved in smuggling. You never knew who was who. And don't think they spoke their local language. They generally didn't. But these commissions, I don't know how many there were. I lost count. They started off under the assumption that Jews could be made, you know, well, they're just Russians of a different religion. They functioned no differently than any criminal mafia would do at the time, and they had a very naive population to work with. So the Polish partitions were not in Russia's interest. I mean, maybe for a time it was in her economic interest, but certainly not in her social interest. Yes, you had the Judaization issue in the 16th century. There was some connection with certain Gnostic and sort of proto-Freemasonic groups, but nothing like this. This was the Jews as such. This was pure Talmudism. They did not speak Russian or German or Polish or anything else. They had no interest in speaking it. Which, of course, brings us to the other concept. What is assimilation? No other group obsesses about themselves like this. For the most part, it was just learning the language of the people they live near. We talked about the Pale of Settlement. The Jews didn't pay taxes there. They were an elite group. These commissions gave them subsidies, land grants that they, of course, you know, they only used just for speculation. And then bringing others, you know, so some of these commissions would say, okay, Jews don't know anything about farming. We want to make them farmers. Okay, so we'll hire some local Slavs to come over and teach them how to do it. Well, what does that mean? That just meant that the local Slavs became their serfs. As the years went on, in Ukraine, the Jews dominated the sugar industry through the beet farming. And the only thing that saved the old Russian Empire from becoming just a total, like England, a dependency of Judaism was the monarchy. I can't tell you how many times I said in the course of, if you haven't listened to it, how many times I said that, you know, in the Jewish mind, Rome is the ultimate enemy. The third Rome is Russia. So this is the Goyim squared. It wasn't that they were forbidden to do anything else. They just didn't want to work. I've been through this with many people 100 times. A day's work was something way beyond them. When I did this with Pete a couple of days ago, I talked about Vito Spadafore in the Sopranos. He couldn't take it. He couldn't take a day's work. You know, fact that he was, He couldn't take a day's work in New Hampshire, so he left to almost certain death. So long as he didn't have to work. It's a very Jewish idea. The parallels between what we consider a mafia and Judaism, especially back then, are substantial. Even the Jewish Encyclopedia does not agree. It totally agrees with me on all of this. Prior to the revolution, for the Jews, before the development of heavy industry, what was most important was a trade of money. Didn't matter whether he was a pawnbroker, money changer, farmer, public, private income, tenant, whatever. He was involved in these financial transactions. He didn't have to work. He didn't have to assimilate. And he could live off the work of others. As time went on, as the areas became monetized, started using currency, there was the demand for money increasing. That can only mean one thing. What saved Russia, of course, was the firm control over the currency by the Tsar, which is why he had to die. They were not going to become ordinary people. They were not ordinary people. Under no circumstances are they ordinary people. It didn't matter whether they spoke the language of the population or not. They were aliens. Remember, Zionism at this point had a tiny handful of adherents. I mean, minuscule. You did have some demand for coinage, for actual currency in rural Russia as things developed here. But that just increased the power of the Jews in this case. And this is coming straight out of the Jewish Encyclopedia, by the way. Under Alexander I, energetic arrangements had subsequently played an important part in the accumulation of capital in the hands of the Jews. And they didn't fail to use this capital successfully in factories and plants, mining, transportation, and banking. What I'm saying here comes straight out of the Jewish Encyclopedia prior to the revolution. That's why it's always important to note that capitalism is just as revolutionary as socialism ever was. Because revolution was in their veins. In the Western world, especially Britain, they had taken over entirely. Again, the Jewish Encyclopedia. So, whenever, you know, there was a problem, tremendous pressure could be put on the Russian Empire from the West, especially Britain, concerning the Jewish question of any type. They tried to, it was difficult in old Russia to enforce laws. It's a very large country. It's very hard to get around. Only a few times of the year can you really move around, either the snow or the mud. So it was very difficult to know who's responding to the census and who isn't. They were always undercounted. They say that by the end of the 19th century, the Jews accounted for 44% of Kievan merchants. In 1916, 100% of merchantry in Petersburg were Jewish. Now, what I have noted many times, and I may have gotten this from Solzhenitsyn, maybe I didn't, and it turns Marxism on its head, is that no Jewish revolutionary launched into Marxism or leftism due to poverty. They almost all came from wealthy families. And in the three volumes of the Russian Jewish Encyclopedia, there's no shortage of examples. Solzhenitsyn points out there's one exception, Paul Axelrod. That was one out of hundreds. Generally speaking, Marxism, various forms of socialism, even before Marx, came from the upper merchant classes, making a mockery of what Marxism was trying to predict. This, of course, led to stress. And the Jews put the name pogrom to it. The stupidest things that they did was to murder Alexander II by several hand-picked Gentiles, but most of the organization, you know, Land and Liberty. Tikhomirov talks about this, was Jewish. And a pogrom occurred afterwards. I'm not sure what else you would expect. But in the first pogrom ever in Odessa, which was the capital of Judaism, essentially, in Eastern Europe, one Jew was killed. Now, because this was an immensely important economic region, they couldn't have lots of violence there. So troops were sent in immediately. And the only people who suffered were local Russians who had legitimate spontaneous rage at these people. Tsar Alexander's murder. He had property destroyed. He had all kinds of stuff like that, but no fatalities were reported. Then you have the Greek issue. The Greeks were also competitors with the Jews, were involved with that. Then you listen to Jewish propaganda today, and they'll say that tens of thousands were murdered. Not only that, but it came from the government. The demand, these pogroms came from the state, which is absurd. They simply couldn't afford it. Andrew Joyce wrote in 2012, in the pages of the Daily Telegraph, it was stated that these Russian atrocities are only the beginning. Russian officials themselves countenance these barbarities. Around this time, in continental Europe, Prussian rabbi Yitzhak Ruf established himself as the intermediary between Eastern Jewry and the West. And according to Clear, his name, John Clear, one of his specialties was spreading of sensationalized accounts of mass rape. Other major sources of pogrom atrocity. Stories were told New York Times, London Times, the Jewish World. In fact, it was the Jewish World that created most of these tales. That's the foundation of the so-called pogroms. The people who were arrested were Russians. But most of the other papers simply printed what the Jewish World sent them. And these ridiculous atrocity stories. Provoked global outrage. There were large-scale public protests against Russia in Paris, Brussels, London, Vienna, Melbourne, Australia even. The American press had, you know, Russians as the ultimate barbarians. The American press even went beyond what the Jewish press was saying. Rapes and brutal beatings for no reason. Russian popular press from 1905 to the Great War is a frightening and disturbing spectacle. They had tremendous power. They were not under state control. Journalists would invent the wildest stories they could for quick sales. There was minimal censorship over the media at the time. I mentioned John Clear, who's an Israeli historian, and he actually does take the Jewish world to task. But they deliberately invented atrocity stories. We're not just talking about the 20th century, but the Kishinev pogrom of 1881, which was, you know, prior to the Holocaust, the Jewish atrocity. But most of these were they were just fabricated. In fact, at the time, there were no significant pogroms and no fatalities in the city. It was simply invented. Other claims that he witnessed shootings of peasants and travels, they've been totally discredited. In fact, he was never there. But what did this do? These atrocity stories created a tremendous Jewish revolutionary sense of purpose. It's what they absolutely needed to keep focused. Clear, at least, is somewhat honest. But these stories of what allegedly occurred in these pogroms were mostly entirely invented. Now I wrote a paper on the pogroms, largely taken from, or inspired by, 200 years ago. He said that I was there when Jews were burned alive in their homes where the authorities looked on, etc. Mutilation of children, etc. You know, no, none of that ever occurred. But it didn't matter if it occurred or not. It created Jewish solidarity. So what did William Randolph Hearst write, the Gentile head of so many newspapers? "We accuse the Russian government of bearing the responsibility for the Chisinau slaughter. We declare that this Holocaust is steeped in blood. It is on Nicholas's door that these killings lie, and this violence. May the God of justice come into this world and finish Russia as he finished with Sodom and Gomorrah, sweeping this hotbed of hate from the earth as a plague." That's from the Baltimore Sun of 1903. Truth is, knowledge of Russia by Americans in 1903 was minimal. Only Harvard offered any kind of language studies. And historians barely knew the basics. It was only the post-revolutionary emigre movement, insular, ineffective, that offered any kind of alternative. So you had elite people like Hearst calling for the total destruction of Russia based on these ridiculous stories. Absurd press reports that could never be verified under any circumstances. The truth, on the other hand, was that in places like in Starodub in 1902, heavily armed Jews sought to evict the Orthodox population from the city to cleanse their region of unclean goyim. It was only called a pogrom when the unclean fought back. There was no restrictions on weapons in the Russian Empire. Jews Jews were well armed, and sometimes with heavy weapons. June 1st, 1906, the Jewish Bund, armed with military-grade weapons, meaning something more than just rifles, attacked a nationalist procession, killing 25. The response to that then became a pogrom. Jews created self-defense units, despite they were not in any danger. They existed to attack Russians and Russians only. But again, it created Jewish solidarity, which was so important. It destroyed any trust that Jews may have had in the state, but they didn't have any trust in the state to begin with. I can go on and on and on. This was a mafia cult within Russian history. There were Jews in universities turned them into revolutionary sects. That's why there was restrictions on Jews in universities. They made workers strike in 1905. Why? You know, socialist revolutionaries, which were mostly Jews, they murdered 15 governors and mayors, 267 security officials, and 12 bishops. That's only a single leftist party in 1 year. Socialist revolutionary. Those killed and injured by leftist terror between 1905 and 1907 was more than 20,000. Majority, overwhelming majority of the terrorists were Jews. So the pogroms were a story that they needed to cover up this violence and create hatred for Jews against the government. But if you've gotten this far, I appreciate it. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, of course, for donating. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.